Welcome to another episode of The Road Untraveled. I'm your host, Brian Hollins, and I'm joined today by my good friend, Layla Seca, partner at Operator Collective, an incredible B2B-focused fund that has built a community-oriented approach with its more than 150 female LPs. Layla spent over 11 years at Salesforce, where she ran the App Exchange and was also responsible for sparking the Equal Pay initiative that catalyzed change for women not only at Salesforce, but also across the tech ecosystem, and is still very much a work in progress today. She's also one of my co-creators at the Black Venture Institute, which is an incredible new program focused on helping leading Black executives across the country to foray into venture capital and begin understanding the ins and outs of angel investing and how to diligence companies at the early stage. We have folks like Bill Gurley, Brad Feld, Charles Hudson, Elliot Robinson, and so many more who are going to ensure that the participants are taught from the best. And I can't wait to see what this program turns into. Feel free to check it out at blackventureinstitute.com. But for now, enjoy my conversation with Layla. This is The Road Untraveled. Hey, Layla, how are you?
I'm fine, Brian. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for being here. Let's jump right in. You spent over 11 years at Salesforce and ran an initiative around equal pay for the firm for females. You know, not only an initiative that was taken up by Benioff for Salesforce, but also one that sort of got rolled out to the broader tech ecosystem. Talk a little bit about that initiative and frankly, some of the work that you think still has to be done to right some of the wrongs that females have faced in the tech industry more broadly.
Sure. So I grew up in product. I was a product manager. I'd always sort of grown up over there. And I tended to be one of the only women in the room. So I'd had a sense for a long time that the pay wasn't equal, just by the way people sort of chatted about things they were buying and things they were doing. And there was an initiative at the company where Mark was trying to highlight more female executives inside the organization and raise them up. So I was one of the ones that got raised up. And as I did that, a friend of mine, Cindy, also had a similar experience. She became the head of HR. I took over a division called Desk. And I sort of was pushing that we should go for equal pay. So Cindy and I started working through what that would look like. And we ultimately went to Mark and said, the women aren't being paid the same as the men. And his initial reaction to that was like, no, that can't be true. There's no way. But we told him we really wanted to take a look. And so he said, yeah, go ahead. And at that point, there was no playbook for how to do an audit on equal pay or how any of this should work. So Cindy deserves a lot of credit for sort of thinking through how that should come together and all of us working together on it. I think the thing for me was, you know, you and I have talked about this many times, Brian, it's not really an equal world. But the thing that makes me rage is the money, right? Because especially in the United States, money is power. So if we're not ever cut into what we should be earning, how are we ever going to get our power?
100%. We certainly have spent a ton of time talking about this, and I'm excited to get to that topic as well. Just out of curiosity, if you think about some of the work that you did in the early days around convincing people that that work needed to be done, any advice you'd share for folks that are trying to run similar initiatives or around how to start to build some of that momentum within their organizations?
Yeah. I mean, look, consensus. Like we worked for a year before we went to Mark. No one hears that part of the story, but we tried to come up with different things. We kind of tried to come up with ways that we could potentially go about doing the audit. We tried to build consensus, and we ran into a number of people who told us not to do it, right? That we would be putting the company at risk or, you know, but ultimately we sort of kept true to our morals, but we did work hard to get a lot of people bought in, get a lot of people's opinions on the issue, try to really bring a holistic view on the problem forth so that we could take a hard look at it from an analysis perspective. Also, we didn't just bring him a problem and be like, here's a big nasty problem, have at it. We came at him with an idea that we thought something was wrong, and then we came with a solution. We had something we wanted to do. And I think that is a hard part of the work that really makes the difference between seeing programs take off and be super successful and just sort of, you know, beating the drum, both of which are necessary. But I do think if you come to people with actionable steps, like I want to do this and that and this and that, and here's the outcome, and bring it back to math and numbers, like here are the things I anticipate we'll be able to do, people have an easier time getting behind what you're trying to make happen.
Fantastic. Let's just look through the crystal ball for a little bit. You know, we have organizations like AllRaise now, what's the work that still needs to be done? What do you think is still missing that in kind of 5 to 10 years from now, we'll look back and say, yeah, that was the thing that finally got this over the hump?
You know, I think that a lot of it is a demystification process, right? The folks that have been in charge haven't necessarily given us a guidebook on how to do things, right? So a lot of times it feels like things are hard, or it's hard to break in. It's hard to know how to get in, what the language is, you know, what the jargon is, who's who. So I think opening up a lot of those doors, which All Raise has done a great job. I'm good friends with all those folks and huge fans of theirs. Also Black VC, which, you know, you're a member of, I'm a huge fan of, another organization that's done some great work. But, you know, one thing that I remember from Equal Pay, you know, we did Equal Pay in the first year, we found a $3 million gap at Salesforce. And then the second year, we found another $3 million gap. And then the third year, we found another $3 million gap. And, you know, we bought a lot of companies, and a lot of things happened during that time. But the real lesson there, and the one that I think is hard for people to completely grab, is like, there's no finish line in equality. Mm-hmm. There's no like, oh, I did it, I'm done. Oh, I did Equal Pay at Salesforce, now I'm done. I did, like, this is my life's work. This should be all of our lives' work, because the country is not equal. And it's gonna take a lot of work to make it more equal, to make it the promise which we all believed it could be. So, you know, I really encourage people to take action, to do stuff. And I think organizations like All Raise pave a path, as does Black VC, for people to think about different ways for them to live their life, have their career, different thoughts on who they can be professionally and in the world. And I think those are important. You know, you can't be what you can't see, as they say, Brian. So the more we can show people all the different permutations of how they can live their life and have their career, the more diversity we're going to get in the higher ranks throughout Silicon Valley.
That's great. Let's pivot to venture. Give folks who may not be familiar with Operator Collective a sense of what you guys are building. I'm obviously a huge fan and super excited and could probably tell the story, but really, really would love for you to just give a little bit of the 101 on Operator Collective and what you guys are up to.
Sure. So my partner, Malin Yen, actually started the firm. I joined her a few months after. The idea here being that venture up until this point has pretty much been a world dominated by founders and venture capitalists, right? Venture capitalists give money to founders, founders go build awesome things, and then they sell those things and everyone makes a lot of money. The problem with this scenario is most of the time the venture capitalist is a white man, the founder is a white man, and the LPs in the venture capitalist fund are white men. So the cycle of wealth tends to be really concentrated amongst an elite few. So the idea of our fund was, if we can change who the investors are, we can change the kinds of companies that are being built, right? If we want companies that have women and people of color and different perspectives and people that grew up in different places and went to different schools, if we want all of that representation to come into the companies and the products that we build, then we have to change the way we're building companies. So Operator Collective was born of that idea, that if we could make different types of people investors, we could have different types of companies. So we have over 130 LPs, 90% of them are women, 40% of them are people of color, 20% of them are immigrants. All of them are or have been operating executives at some of the most successful companies in the world. And all of them are very interested in being more involved. And I'll just give you an anecdote on why the fund resonates so hard. We're just under a year old. We'll be a year old in the beginning of December. And right before we launched last year, I queried our LP base with a survey. And I asked them, how many of you have invested before? And you know, these women are ballers, right? Like they were $1 billion businesses. They're the real deal, right? So I asked a question. I said, how many of you have invested before? And over 75% of our LPs came back and said they'd never invested before. And the next question was, if you answered, I've never invested before, why is that? And the resounding answer back was, no one had ever asked me. Again, being that opportunities exist all over the place that people are passing to each other, and a large group of us are cut out of that opportunity, right? Just because we're not friends with, went to school with, grew up with, in the same place as, what have you. So, you know, Operator Collective was born to really change that and make venture, A, more accessible to everyone as an investing tool, and B, to really change the types of companies that come out of Silicon Valley and to make them more like the types of companies we want our kids to work at.
So it's so incredible. I think about so much of the work that we do together, focusing on Black VC and some of the initiatives there. I mean, there are so many talented people who venture is such a mythological beast to them. They never got access. They never got exposure. And I think the second that you bring them in and sort of pull the veil off, they realize they've been doing much, much more complicated, much more sophisticated, oftentimes much more difficult things in their other worlds. And so I'm so glad to hear that you feel like the Operator Collective ecosystem is introducing people in a lot of ways to venture, because I think it's so important.
Absolutely. And it's not that hard. I mean, yes, it's hard. There's like anything, you need to learn it. But once you learn it, this is not brain surgery, right? It's an accessible way of thinking about investing your money if you're lucky enough to have some to invest. Like, but often these worlds feel, even for me, you know, I ran the App Exchange at Salesforce. That's the most successful, largest enterprise app ecosystem on the planet. And if you'd asked me a year and a half ago if I was going to go into venture, I would have been like, oh, I don't know enough. I mean, that's really hard. I don't know. You know, I would have talked to myself all the reasons why I couldn't do it. So I think it's really important that we teach more people the language and open up the doors and open up those opportunities to different kinds of people so that we can have different kinds of companies.
Absolutely. For the person that doesn't get the Operator Collective call, what are some of the ways to just become more familiar or build proximity to venture capital that you think of? Like if you knew nothing about venture, but you were 6 years at Pinterest or 7 years at Slack, like what are some of the ways that you think are the right ways to dip your toes in?
Well, first of all, you know a lot more about venture than you think, right? Like if you were 6 years at Pinterest or 3 years at Slack, you may not know the ins and outs of all of it, but you actually do know a lot more. That's part of like the unveiling. I knew much more about venture than I thought I did. In fact, I'd sort of been training for this job my whole life, running that ecosystem, but hadn't really realized it. Second, you can learn a lot on Twitter and LinkedIn. You can learn a lot just by following people and sort of getting a sense for who people are and what they talk about. I also think that, there are great programs, there are great visionaries that are out there trying to educate folks that are not as proficient in venture capital, that are around on Twitter, on LinkedIn, in different places where you can get a lot of resource for free or an incredibly accessible price to sort of get a sense of what's going on. I mean, and for us, what you and I have been working on for the last 6 months was Black Venture Institute, which was really focus specifically on this particular issue, which is bringing a group of Black operating executives into a forum where we can teach them all about venture capital, give them access to all of the people that are sort of, behind the curtain in venture capital, and really unmask that as an option for them to think about whether or not they want to become an angel investor, or they want to be an LP in a fund, or they want to become a GP in a fund, or what have you, but to really begin the demystification process of venture and with this very specific cohort. So obviously that's a program where you and I spend a lot of our energy working on, but I think about things like that whenever possible.
Yeah, that's great. And I'll take the second to shout out our whole team. We've been working together tirelessly over the summer with Berkeley and Salesforce and obviously Operator Collective and Black VC. So excited for everyone that's listening. Stay tuned. Black Venture Institute is just in its early days, but I'm really excited about some of the things that are going to come out of that ecosystem and some of the change that's going to be coming to the venture industry. Let's switch to a little bit of just the ins and outs and blocking and tackling, if you will, of Operator Collective. Give us a sense of, from an investing perspective, what you guys are focused on, what you're interested in, some of the trends you're watching. Just kind of put on your VC hat for a little bit and let's talk about what the Operator Collective team is thinking about.
Sure. So we only invest in enterprise B2B SaaS, clearly, right? Mallon's wheelhouse, my wheelhouse, that's sort of where we came from. We're seeing a lot of great stuff. I mean, no surprise, there's an interesting foray into productivity apps across a number of different disciplines. And I, for one, am seeing some pretty amazing stuff on the dev productivity side, which is pretty exciting. COVID is such a miserable moment and such a hard time, and so many people are in so much pain. But in the same right, there's this strange renaissance in enterprise B2B technology where a lot of the limitations we had faced over the last 20 years around people needing their, you know, instances to be in-house, or people need to run it from their desk, or some of these things that are now no longer true because of COVID have ushered in a new age of productivity app, as well as sort of a renaissance in B2B SaaS. So we're seeing a lot of cool stuff on that side across the board, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, that's awesome. Give us a name or two from the portfolio that might not get the TechCrunch or the Forbes coverage, or didn't come flying through YC, that you're super excited about that maybe no one's talking about.
I love all my companies. I love all my children equally, but I'm very excited about a company called Cube. It's EPM software. So specifically, you know, I grew up at Salesforce, so I spent a lot of time with the finance team doing planning for this year, planning for next year, planning in the quarter, planning in the month. And that was always, they were great people, but it always took a lot of work and was really a long time. And the tools we had at our disposal weren't very helpful. So Cube is approaching, you know, EPM with an eye towards making the CFO really a very strategic business partner. And I think in the age of COVID, that becomes even more important, but also embracing the way people work. So I was an executive at Salesforce for many, many years, and I spent tons of time in budgets and in financing, but I didn't want to go into the finance system. I worked in spreadsheets. So Cube gets that and has embraced that notion to really create a system that gets executives the information they need and allows them to work the way they want, while still giving finance sort of this centralized data that allows them to be really strategic in helping the business make decisions.
Sounds super exciting. How do you source in the middle of COVID, Layla? Like how do you look a founder in the eyes on Zoom and say, I'm going to give you money because I just believe in what you're doing? Like, have you figured, I mean, it's not 2 months or 3 months anymore. Like, we're going on, you know, you got to deploy capital. Like, how are you guys figuring that out?
You know, we were born on Zoom, like Operator Collective. We don't have an office. We never did. We all work in our houses. And you know, Malin and I would meet in the city and go listen to pitches and everything. But we did the lion's share of our work. You know, our operating partner lives in Vancouver. Our head of marketing lives in Texas. Everyone was sort of all over the country to begin with. So on that side, we had the working infrastructure as a firm to do that. As far as with founders, you know, a lot of it's gut. And no one wants to say that. Everyone wants to act like there's some really like fancy algorithm that only really successful venture capitalists have running in their head. But a lot of it's gut. And although that translates very easily in person, I can tell from Zoom if you're a schmuck or if you're true. Like I can tell, like if I'm looking at you on Zoom and we're talking, I can tell if you know what you're talking about or if you're trying to play me a little bit. And then what is always the case in Silicon Valley and with venture is we all back channel. Right? So I might meet you and think you're fabulous, but then I ask people that we have in common about you. And that's how a lot of reputations are made, right? So, I mean, I think to younger folks that are listening to this, be careful, you know, be nice to everyone. That would be my biggest piece of advice. I think I did that more or less successfully through most of my career without even really realizing it. But it's important to treat people well because you never know 10, 20 years later, who's going to be on the other side of a decision that is important to you, and how you treat them along the way will matter.
Yeah, that's great advice. I've had the pleasure of watching you just absolutely be a beast of a fundraiser through our Black Venture Institute experience, but you've also been a beast raising an entire fund as well. So I want to make sure that we get a little bit of your advice, you know, both for founders and emerging managers around navigating a male dominated world as a female fundraiser, and any advice that you'd have on sort of how to cut through the noise or things that you wish you did a little bit differently that may be helpful for someone starting in that process now.
You have to have heavy conviction in yourself. There were a number of meetings we walked out of. You know, Malin has a couple funny stories. I have a couple funny stories. Not everyone is going to understand what you're trying to do or why it's important. And it's better not to spend all your time trying to convince people that don't get it, and instead really focus on the ones that do and try to meet more of those. I would say that, you know, I think it's important. It's sort of like that founder thing. Fundraising is similar. You're going to work with these people. They're going to be part of your life. Like you want to make sure they're the type of people you want to spend your time with. So you have to be somewhat deliberate about that too, I would say.
Yeah, that's great. I want to double click on that a little bit. You talked about finding someone you want to work with. You obviously found Malin, who's an incredible investor as well, and just genuinely an incredible person. But for someone that's starting to think about how to find a good partner for either a business or for raising a fund, any advice you'd have on how to go through that process thoughtfully?
Yeah. Like, I believe complementary skills are the best. Malin and I are great partners because we're very different. We're very similar in certain ways, but we're very different, right? She's wildly detail-oriented. I am less detail-oriented, right? We have different skill sets that really complement each other beautifully, and we let each other do the thing that the other's good at. Like, you know, I'm good at marketing. Malin lets me do marketing, right? She doesn't try to come in and tell me how to do marketing all the time. Malin is great at pricing. I don't go in and tell Malin, you know, like, we sort of respect each other's skills and only look for ways to augment each other and make the whole greater than the sum of its parts, right? You know, like, sort of rise up together. The other thing when it comes to partnership, really the only thing that matters is trust. Do you trust this person? Like, do you really trust this person? Because if you're going to go into that kind of a relationship, it's like a marriage, you know? It's a big commitment to move into partnership with someone. So you want to make sure who you're doing that with is someone you really trust.
Yeah, that's great. Let's talk a little bit about the sort of top of funnel sourcing process. One of the things that really gets under my skin is when people tell me that they can't find Black or female founders, that there's none out there, that they don't exist. Talk a little bit about sort of how you source underrepresented founders, so some of the ecosystems that you're a part of that you look to for finding high quality founders, and any advice you'd have for people that say that they're struggling to do so.
Yeah, I mean, you know, better, never done, right? There's always more work to do. We have more work to do at Operator Collective on this front too. I think everyone does. Naturally, our network has been very helpful, right? I mean, there is some, it's no surprise that so many of the founders are from the same network, right? Because our network is, we see a lot of female founders. We see a lot of diverse founders, and that's partially because of the network we have around us. I think the key to doing this is to be deliberate. Right? If you are not deliberate about who you look for and how you do your sourcing and the different types of companies you look at, you're not going to get a diversified portfolio. You'll get one that looks like the community you live in. It's just sort of the way it goes. So I think it really takes a lot of deliberation, and you have to look for it. And here's the other thing, ask for help. I was not afraid, nor was Malin along the way, to ask people for help when we were trying to find, you know, more Black operators to join as LPs, or when we were looking for, you know, women engineers to join, you know, like we went and sort of sought people out inside of our network and asked them to invite us, to, you know, to introduce us to other people in their network. So I do think if you have the right type of relationship with people, you can ask for help. Just be very clear about what you're asking for help for. Don't go to someone and be like, I'm not diverse. Okay, well, I can't do anything with that, you know. Come to me and say, I need a woman who's in engineering. I need a woman who's sat on a public board. Tell me the things you need, and then I can help try to find you the right people.
Yeah, that's great. Two more for you, Layla. This has been super fun. I really appreciate you being here. The first one is, what do you wish you knew before you started at Salesforce? If you could go back to your early days in starting your career, just some of the tactical things that you wish you had been equipped with that might have made you a little bit better at your job.
I think overall, I should have had more confidence in myself. I'm actually quite insecure in my own weird way. So if I just had a wee bit more confidence, probably things wouldn't have taken as much of a toll on me as they did. So that's a little bit personal, but that's there. I think that what I didn't realize so much at Salesforce was that we were doing everything for the first time. So I was sort of always trying to find a model for us to follow where what we were actually doing was creating the model. So, I mean, I guess that I probably would have been a little bit more cognizant of the fact that was happening and relished that as opposed to being frustrated by it, which I felt quite a bit. But in general, you know, I think the advice, I don't really have too many regrets about Salesforce. That was a pretty rock awesome 11 years. I'm pretty pleased with what happened there.
Yeah, I certainly didn't ask it in a way that I thought you'd change your path, because I wouldn't change your path. All you got to do is pull up your LinkedIn to know that you shouldn't change anything about your path. So obviously a very successful and talented human being, and I feel very fortunate to have you as a friend. The last one I have for you, if you could go back to your junior year or senior year of college, what do you wish you would have started in? What industry do you wish you would have gone and interned in and just kind of started to build a career where you just think that industry is just getting started and there's a ton of potential, and as a 20-year-old, you really could be on the cutting edge of it?
So not when I was in college, like now, because none of this existed when I was in college, because I'm like your mom's age, Brian. Correct. But look, I really think, you know, everyone says these things like data is the new oil and there's all this type of things. There is so much data on the planet now. And the interesting thing about data is it can be argued both ways, right? If you give me a data set, I can argue yay and I can argue nay in the same numbers. So that it's almost like the law on that regard. So I think that if I were in college right now, I would look at data and statistics in a new way. I think that the way we're going to be able to start to derive information and insights from data and that is statistically relevant and then potentially do interesting stuff with that data will eventually be the applications and the things we all lean on in our life. And I imagine that will happen sooner than we think it will.
Love it. Layla Seca, Operator Collective, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Oh, Brian, you're one of my favorites. Thank you for having me. What a gift.
Of course. Take care.
Take care, kiddo.